Now, scientifically, have you ever wondered how life started in the universe, how it started here on this planet? In a moment, we'll be talking our cosmic ancestry in the stars on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast, and back with us, because he was last with me almost 2 years ago, Sandra Wickramasinghe. He's a PhD, director of the Center for Astrobiology at the University of Buckingham, so we're going live to the United Kingdom. His latest work is called The Cosmic Ancestry in the Stars. Sandra, welcome back. Good to talk to you again.
Thank you. Nice getting back to you. Yeah.
What's going on in the cosmos these days?
Oh, a lot. I think they're discovering new planets, planets with water on them, asteroids hurtling past the Earth, and so on. So there's a lot happening.
You know, they keep talking about asteroids out there, and a lot of times, Doctor, they will spot them after they've passed the planet. What are the possibilities we're going to get hit by a pretty good-sized one?
Well, I hope it doesn't hit us in the near future. It's bound to do that in some distant moment in time, but I think it's going to be at least a few hundred years before an asteroid might strike us. Not so long ago, there was a small asteroid that hurtled past the Earth at a distance of about 10 times the distance to the moon. This is only a couple of weeks ago. There are lots of things happening, new planets discovered, water on those planets being discovered, and so on. So it's a hive of astronomy, and space science is a hive of activity.
You came out with a remarkable proposal years ago that said that there's dust in the universe, but that it was full of organic molecules. What did your colleagues say about that?
Well, at the time that we first proposed it, they thought we were nuts. It was heavily refuted. People even like Carl Sagan and his team said that this is impossible because organic molecules are so fragile that they wouldn't last in deep space. But as it turned out, we were right. Within a few years, within at least 3 or 4 years, the discovery was confirmed in very many different ways. And so now we know that the galaxy is just chock-a-block with organic molecules, organic dust.
Now, not to knock religion by any means, because I still think there's some kind of creation behind all of this genius out there.
Yes, certainly, yeah, I would agree with you, yeah.
In your opinion, how did life start here on good old planet Earth?
Well, I think we know that to a fair degree of certainty now. When I first started working on these matters, which is sort of 3 or 4 decades ago, the belief was that the first evidence, the oldest evidence of life on Earth, was at something like 3,500 million years ago. That's a long time ago, but it was supposed to be about a billion years after the Earth itself had formed into a planet. And so astronomers and scientists and biologists and so all these people were hopeful that within a billion years, some kind of primordial soup would develop on the Earth, and chemistry would achieve the transition from no life to life. But that hope has all but vanished now, because we know that the very, very oldest evidence of microbial life, microscopic life on the Earth, is at the very first moment, absolutely the first moment, that such life can survive. These have been discovered in the form of little traces, fossils, microscopic fossils, in rocks that were formed at this time, and they're exposed in certain parts of the world. In Australia, for instance, there have been rocks that turned up 4.1 billion years old, 4.2 billion years old maybe even, with signs, unambiguous signs of microscopic life. So the conclusion I think one has to come to is that this life was not generated on the Earth. There was no primordial soup on the Earth at this time. The Earth was far too hot. It was just a cauldron of boiling material, lava, and so on. And into that, comets came and deposited the first simple life forms which were essentially bacteria, single-celled bacteria. So that's how it started. So it essentially puts back the beginnings of life to a location that is very, very far away and much, much bigger than the Earth, the universe itself. And I think there we have a much bigger, better chance of the step from no life to life. I think it's an incredibly improbable transition. If you think of the kind of information that is needed to put life together, it is mind-blowing. It's sort of what we have described as being super astronomical. I think my colleague, my late colleagues, Fred Hoyle and I, described it as very similar to a tornado blowing through a junkyard. Mm-hmm. I mean, tornadoes often in the United States. Just imagine all the rubble in a pile of junk, sort of swirled around by a tornado, and just putting together a brand new working Boeing 747 or one of these modern airplanes. It's just incredibly, incredibly improbable. So I think one has to regard the first origin of life as being pretty close to being a miracle.
Yes.
But certainly did not happen here on the Earth. There's no way in which it happened on the Earth. And
can this miracle happen on other planets that have water and they're close enough to their sun where it's not too hot and not too cold?
Yeah, any planet that is not close enough to the sun or too close to the sun to have water and the right conditions, in what they call the Goldilocks zone of these exoplanets, you could have the same process by which life started on the Earth. And it didn't happen in situ on those planets. It couldn't have happened again for the same reasons of improbability. The beginnings of life has to be regarded as a cosmic miracle, as a cosmic event. And once it happened at some very distant time in the cosmological past, and here is an opportunity for the miracle to be a sort of religious even miracle, type of a God-created miracle. One cannot rule that out. But it has to happen not on the scale of a little planet like Earth or one of these many, many exoplanets that have been discovered, but it has to happen on a cosmological, on a universal scale. So creation of life in all its multifaceted forms has to be in the void. It has to happen on a cosmic scale.
What about luck? Because they say, for example, had the asteroid not struck 63 million years ago, killing the dinosaurs, we never would have evolved and we would not have been here. Do you agree with that?
Well, I think that's certainly true. I think luck has played a big role in bringing the little bits and pieces together, that the genetic bits that were strung together into humans. Luck has played a role in the case of the dinosaurs, in knocking out the dinosaurs and removing the dinosaurs and allowing small mammals to fill the major niches of the Earth. So if not for the extinction, or if not for that comet that hit 65 million years ago, I think we would still be having dinosaurs, and human beings would not have had a chance to emerge. Even if the information, the genes, the DNA that was responsible for leading to humans might have been arriving in the form of comet dust and so forth, the actual emergence, the arrival of Homo sapiens would not have been permitted because of the bigger predators that would have prevented this.
Well, Doctor, it's very possible that there could be planets teeming with life, but they may have all fish or land-based creatures and no humans. Is that possible?
Yeah, I agree. I think the amount of life that develops, the types of life that develop on any given planet outside the Earth depends on conditions, on the local conditions. If there, for instance, if a planet has no atmosphere and only watery environments, huge oceans, then you wouldn't expect to have land animals, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
It's, that's quite clear. So it depends what takes root on any given planet. It depends on the conditions, the local conditions that prevail there. So it is very much constrained by what is available on any given planet. We know, of course, now from the recent studies of exoplanets, and incidentally, the first discovery of an exoplanet in 1995 has been rewarded this year. Queloz and Mayer have been given the Nobel Prize or shared the Nobel Prize for the very first discovery of a what they call an exoplanet. And since then, of course, since the Queloz-Mayer discovery, there have been at least several thousand exoplanets that have been discovered, and many, many of these are probably habitable. They are in the Goldilocks zone. The present estimate is really interesting because we have 100 billion stars in the galaxy, like the Sun, and we have about 100 billion. The estimate is that there are 100 billion Earth-like exoplanets in our Milky Way system, in our galaxy. So planets that can support life are really quite widespread in our galaxy, in our universe.
How possible is it, Doctor, that given the right conditions on a planet, that this chemical of life through this primordial soup will eventually all end up the same? I mean, it's like if you have 100 tomato seeds and you plant them in 100 different places, you're going to still get tomato plants.
I think so. As I told you, I don't believe that the primordial soup is a local event.
Right.
If you think of a primordial soup story that goes back to Aristotle in the 3rd century BC, he was the guy who essentially started this whole story of the primordial soup, which, incidentally, primordial soup on a planet is a total myth. There's no evidence for it. So the primordial soup has to be a cosmic primordial soup, a cosmological primordial soup in the whole universe. And once life has started, in every possible facet of life would have been essentially set in train at some very, very distant time, cosmological time in the past. So when planets like the Earth form, they are rained upon by all the bits and pieces that can get together, the genes, the genetic units, which I think in the form of bacteria and viruses, they fall in onto these planets in comet dust and meteorite dust and so forth, and they essentially fit together like a jigsaw puzzle to form the different types of life. So if the bits are the same, if the units are the same, then the types of life and the range of different life forms one gets has to be very similar from one planet to another. What I think one has to regard the whole galaxy, certainly, and perhaps the whole universe, is as a single connected biosphere. We are used to thinking of a biosphere that is Earth-based. We think that the Earth itself is a closed system, and that's not going to be the correct perspective in the fullness of time. The Earth is an open system, receiving material, biological material, from very, very distant places in the universe. And so the whole universe is one connected biosphere. The connection also follows because we know that the solar system, connection of us to the rest of the cosmic biology, is ensured because our solar system, which includes the Earth, there's a huge circuit around the center of the galaxy, and this circuit takes 240 million years to complete. To do one loop around the center of the galaxy takes 240 million years, and in that course of time, in that time scale, the Earth, the planets on the Earth and everywhere in our solar system is exposed to the huge legacy of cosmic life that is distributed throughout the galaxy, throughout our Milky Way. So in this way, the galaxy, our Milky Way, becomes a thoroughly mixed system, a connected biosphere. And so it's, I think it's inevitable that if creatures develop on other planets that are very, very similar to the Earth, then we would have similar, generally similar life forms, maybe even humans.
I think so, too. What about the possibility, Doctor, of multiverses, and we have this happening everywhere, other universes as well?
It's entirely likely, and I think I personally think it's highly probable, because what is regarded as conventional wisdom in cosmology, which is the study of how the universe itself began, the conventional wisdom is that it all started with a Big Bang 13.8 billion years ago. Now, you've got to realize that 13.8 billion years ago is scarcely three times the age of the Earth, right?
That's right.
It's not much. The universe itself, on this standard, so-called standard model, is not much older than the Earth. Three or four times older than the Earth. And the multiverse idea is gaining a lot of credence now, because the standard Big Bang, which says that everything started 13.8 billion years ago, is beginning to look a bit shaky. There are areas of astronomy, areas of cosmology, that are yielding results that really are very difficult to reconcile with a single Big Bang event. And so the idea that there are many, many universes, that there were universes that were around before the Big Bang, and so on, this is still a strong possibility. I think we should also remember that at every moment in human history, we've thought that we had the final answer to how the world began, and every time we've turned out to be wrong. Now, there's no guarantee, there's no obvious reason why we should be right this time, even though our technology is much better, we have much better views about physics and better telescopes and so on. It could be just a transition towards a different point of view that would emerge maybe in 10, 20, or 100 years.
That's dramatic what's happening out there in space, to be sure. But you are a believer in a higher power, aren't you?
I think there's no easy answer to how the organization of the first life happened by purely random processes. We have argued and used many similes, like the tornado blowing through a junkyard comparison, that this is as ridiculous to say that life emerged in a primordial soup as to say that a tornado blowing through a junkyard put together something as sophisticated, as marvelous as a Boeing 747. There are also other similes, comparisons that we've made, which are sort of funny. I think we have in one of our books said that it is, if you think of 300 people, blindfolded people, given what is called a Rubik Cube. I don't know whether your listeners would remember this now, but 10 or 15 years ago, it was quite a popular toy.
They remember that. Hold on for a second, Doctor, where you have to take a break, but we'll come back and pick it up right there. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, along with Dr. Rick Ramasinghe. We are talking about his latest work called The Cosmic Ancestry in the Stars. Now, not necessarily how did life start, but this question would be, Doctor, what is life? I mean, I'm still trying to figure that out. Why are we even here in the first place?
Yeah, that's a trillion-dollar question. I think if we can answer that, we might even credit ourselves being God, G-O-D, the creator himself. I think it's absolutely the most wonderful miracle that we can conceive of. And I was telling you how improbable it is for non-life, non-living organic molecules to turn into life. And we talked about the tornado through the junkyard, blowing through a junkyard, making a Boeing 747 as a ridiculous kind of comparison. It's as improbable as that. And also, we, at the time that we had the commercial, Break Brook for the commercial, the one we're talking about, Rubik Cube, and you said people probably do remember the Rubik Cube. If I gave 300 blindfolded people a fully scrambled Rubik Cube, right, and asked them to make just one move, the probability of getting the very simplest, smallest bacterium, the genes of the smallest bacterium, the proteins of the smallest bacterium, is like this group of 300 people solving the Rubik Cube just in one move,
right.
One sort of random move, putting all the colors and on the right faces. So it is incredibly, incredibly improbable and pretty close to a miracle. But once that miracle has happened, and we know it has happened because we are there, the continuation of that miracle and the transference of the information that is in life to other places, to distant places, even very far away places, is inevitable. We, the biologists now know that the genes of simple organisms like bacteria, viruses, insects, and so on, can even be transferred to humans and to mammals, and that's called horizontal gene transfer. Right? And this is an important process in understanding how species change, how species evolve. But that process of gene transfer, I think, cannot be regarded as being confined to our planet, because our planet is constantly leaking material to space. And also we are constantly receiving material from deep space in the form of meteorite dust, comet dust, and so on. So from very distant places in the galaxy, in our Milky Way, we are getting information that is potentially connected with life. So the whole life scene, the panorama of life, the miraculous panorama of life, I think has to be regarded as a huge interconnected cosmic biosphere. So we are part of that biosphere, and I think one of the questions that people are really very interested to ask is, are we alone as intelligent or maybe super intelligent species?
And now many believe we've been visited.
A very, very ancient question that's been asked. Are we alone? Are humans the only intelligent life form in the universe? And I think we are, at the moment we don't have a definite answer, but I cannot for one moment believe that the intelligence, the experiment of intelligence here on the Earth that led to ourselves, led to modern humans, is anywhere near complete. I think we are going to get more and more intelligent here on the Earth if we don't destroy ourselves, that is, in the future. And it is likely that this same process, the same experiment of intelligence will be distributed quite widely elsewhere amongst these thousands or millions, I think now we know that billions, in fact, of habitable planets that exist in our Milky Way system, in our galaxy.
And they keep finding more. Now, many people, Doctor, believe that we have been visited by intelligence beings that are out there through UFOs and flying craft and things like that, which could be a strong possibility. I mean, even the Navy now admits that they do not say extraterrestrial. They keep that out of the equation. But they do say, you know, we've been chasing these objects. We don't know what they are.
Yeah, I think we don't have the facts. We don't have all the facts, and we just cannot rule it out. The prospects of having intelligent or super intelligent creatures, intelligent life forms in our immediate cosmic vicinity is a real possibility in view of all that we know now. So the possibility certainly exists that such intelligent or super intelligent life forms might in the past have visited the Earth or gone very close to the Earth, swung by the Earth and taken a good look at us at least. And so these are not entirely science fiction. I mean, it used to be considered to be bizarre science fiction, But now we know that this kind of thing is entirely probable. We had not so long ago a comet from maybe some people think it's a spaceship called Oumuamua. And it sort of came from very, very distant parts of our galaxy outside of our solar system, swung past, not so close to the Earth, but swung past our vicinity, went round the sun, and went back into space. And now there's another comet, I think, sort of two in a matter of 3 years, another what is called an hyperbolic comet in a hyperbolic orbit that has been spotted, called Comet Boris. And that's heading towards the sun at the moment. So are these all just bits of rock, or are they spaceships? And I think the jury is out. In some cases, maybe we not have seen those cases yet, we might have some object from an intelligently constructed, contrived object that is carrying out some kind of reconnaissance or surveillance of our solar system.
What does this do to Darwin's theories of evolution, Doctor?
I think Darwin's theories of evolution are just, it's the icing on the cake, as it were. It's fine-tuning. I mean, we have all this stuff happening from very, very far away, from the deep cosmos. Life has been put in place in its multifaceted forms by a creative event, a miraculous, almost near miraculous creative event, and we receive the components that we assemble, rather like bits of a jigsaw puzzle, keep on being added to life forms, various life forms on the Earth, and so on. And Darwin, the Darwinian story of natural selection, survival of the fittest, operates against that backdrop. We have new genes coming from space, right? New genetic material, new properties of life, new possibilities for life coming. And these may or may not be taken up by the existing fauna and flora and different life that exists. But if they are taken up, then they are sifted according to the Darwinian paradigm. What is fittest for survival survives, and what is not essentially dies off. So it's essentially a sieve. The Darwinian story is valid to a point, but I think the bigger story is the story is the emergence of life, all the complexities of life, the miraculous complexities of life being so almost created at a cosmic level.
Are you baffled at how life may have started?
Absolutely. I mean, if I can answer that question of how life, against all the most incredible odds, happened in the first place, I would be a very happy person. I might even be God.
That's true. That's absolutely true. Yeah.
I think it's an unanswered question. And I personally think that it probably would never be answered. And this is the reason for creation stories, for religions and so on, to have a niche in our mode of thinking. I think we cannot entirely rule out the possibility, and I think it's a real possibility, that there was a deliberate act of creation in some deep history of the universe, at some very distant time in the past, at a cosmological level. But exactly what that creative event was, and whether there was a super, super intelligence behind that, which most religious people equate to God, that would remain an open question for a very long time. We would have our beliefs. We can justify our beliefs to varying degrees, but it would remain, I think, one of the outstanding mysteries of lives of humanity.
Now, biologically speaking, you know, little organisms come here on comets, land in the ocean, and they begin to multiply. How in the world did it end up coming to where we are today? Just from those little tiny organisms that came here, bacteria and everything else.
Yeah, I think it's like asking the question, if you have a lot of Lego pieces, you know, or jigsaw pieces thrown around, how do these pieces get together and make a marvelous picture? And it's like that. It's, I think, just the assembly, all the bits and pieces that are needed for making a human being or an elephant or a butterfly are all coming in the form of genetic fragments, of genetic units. And when they come on the earth and come into one place on the earth, they can get sifted and sorted out. It's an improbable event, but it must happen, and that's what we are witnessing. Humans, for instance, we know that Homo sapiens ourselves, we arose probably at the beginning of the Pleistocene, so-called Pleistocene era, which is about 2.5 million years ago. These are the oldest skeletons that have now been unearthed. And the connection with the earlier forms, our ancestors were essentially great apes and chimpanzees and so on. And we know from modern gene sequencing, right? DNA has been sequenced. Human DNA is completely sequenced in the year 2000, at the turn of the millennium. And many, many insects and animals and even extinct animals that have been sequenced now through their fossil remains. And we know that in the case of humans, 8% of our DNA is made up of viruses that seem to have come from outside our system. And so this is these are the bits and pieces that made the difference between the viruses, the viroids, the DNA, that made the difference between our earlier, less advanced ancestors and ourselves. So they came in bits and got assembled like bits of a jigsaw puzzle. The last bits of the jigsaw puzzle that made ourselves is in the form of DNA that came from outside.
How far do you think, Doctor, we can advance as a species, maybe over the next couple hundred years? Will we change much?
I think that's an open question. I don't think that we're at the end of the road in evolution, if you accept the story that life has progressively changed from simple to more complex and so on, from bacteria to multicelled creatures to humans eventually. That process must surely continue. We cannot be anywhere near the end of the road. We are probably at the beginning in terms of intelligence, of the beginning of the road. And so who knows what's going to happen in 1,000 years from now. We might be a super, super intelligent superhuman, capable of doing lots of things that we don't even dream of these days.
Are you excited about the future of humanity? Some people
are. I think
aren't.
I'm excited about the future of humanity because the prospects are really, really great. I cannot believe that we are, as I said, we are at the end of the road. I think there are great achievements that lie ahead if we remain intact and don't blow ourselves out completely through nuclear holocaust and stuff. We would continue to make progress. And we would achieve greater and greater things in terms of understanding the world around us, exploiting the immediate vicinity of our own solar system, exploring planets and so on. And we would perhaps going on holiday to Mars, to the moon even maybe, and
yeah,
so forth. So I think our distant ancestors would have a great time doing all these things if we allow ourselves to stay alive, to continue. I think the prospects are great.
Well, that's an important possibility for us to stay alive. For whatever reason, or however we try to survive, mankind might screw it up.
Man can mess it up, and I think we are seeing signs of it all over the world, isn't it? The wars in Syria and other places and so on. I think this is a clear indication of the worst of humankind, the worst aspects of humanity. We should try to overcome that kind of difficulty, I think, and if we can overcome that, then the prospects are really great.
We're going to come back and take a final hour of phone calls with you next, Doctor, so stay with us. Calls next.